is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
45% of the national budget is going towards debt servicing, which of course starves other areas of economic endeavor from being funded by government resources.
That was Zambian economist Yusuf Dudia on how the government's foreign debt burden is destroying the nation's economy. Details coming up. Also, experts say an October coup in Sudan, led by Army Chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, has stoked a resurgence in ethnic violence. These stories and more on African News Tonight. But first, our top story. The UN Refugee Agency says a repatriation program for Congolese refugees wishing to return home from Angola has resumed after a two-year break due to the COVID-19 pandemic. The UNHCR says a first convoy of 88 Congolese refugees left northern Angola and is expected to arrive in the Democratic Republic of Congo today. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
This is the first group of Congolese refugees to head home since the UNHCR's voluntary repatriation program was put on hold in 2020 by the pandemic. The agency says they will stay in a transit center for the night before crossing the border into the DRC. UNHCR spokesman Boris Cheshikov says more than 600 other Congolese refugees so far have indicated they too want to go home. He says other convoys are scheduled to travel through the Chisanda border crossing in the coming weeks. From there, he says, the refugees will head to various destinations in the western DRC, including Kasai, Kasai Central, and Kinshasa, the capital.
Although conflict continues in eastern DRC, improvements in security in the West have reopened the possibility for Congolese to return to their country in dignity and safety. Returning refugees have told UNHCR they are excited to restart their lives in their country after years in exile. Many have not seen family since fleeing political and ethnic violence in DRC's Kasai region in 2017.
At that time, conflict and violence sent some 35,000 Congolese refugees fleeing for their lives to Luanda Norte province in Angola. Since then, thousands of refugees have spontaneously returned to their places of origin in response to reports of improved security. Conditions in eastern DRC, on the other hand, remain extremely volatile. The United Nations says most of the 5.6 million people displaced by conflict and violence inside the country reside in the eastern provinces of North and South Kivu, Ituri, and Tanganyika. Cheshikov says in recent weeks there's been a dramatic rise in the number of people killed and displaced due to attacks by armed groups in those areas.
At the same time, in other parts of the country, we see that the security situation has improved. And what's important is that UNHCR will always continue to advocate for the full support and essential services to be provided by the government, by the authorities, to those that are going back, especially when it comes to security, so they're able to rebuild their lives.
Cheshikov says the returnees receive a reintegration package upon their arrival in the DRC. That, he says, includes cash assistance to help pay their rent and cover basic needs such as personal hygiene and household items. He says additional support is given in enrolling children in school and helping people gather crucial civil documentation essential for the reintegration process to begin. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Experts say an October coup in Sudan led by Army Chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan has stoked a resurgence in ethnic violence. Heavy fighting broke out last week between the Berti and Hausa groups in Sudan's Blue Nile state. At least 79 people have been killed and 199 wounded, while the fighting in Blue Nile State has been quashed since the army was deployed there. Protests have since erupted in other states, with marches in the capital Khartoum and the key eastern cities of Gadarif, Kassala, and Port Sudan. Today, Hausa protesters in Khartoum held up signs demanding justice for the Blue Nile martyrs and no to the murder of Hausas. A prominent Hausa member told the French news agency AFP on condition of anonymity that fighting reportedly broke out on July 11th after Berthis rejected a Hausa request to create a civil authority to supervise access to land. But the senior Berthi leader said the group was responding to a violation of their land by the Hausas. In Sudan, deadly clashes regularly erupt over land, livestock, access to water and grazing, especially in areas awash with weapons and still struggling from the impact of decades of civil war. Reuters reports that the U.S. has been carrying out airstrikes in Somalia to try to defeat Al-Shabaab, an Al-Qaeda franchise seeking to implement its interpretation of Islamic law and overthrow the country's Western-backed central government. U.S. Africa Command, AFRICOM, said in a statement late Monday that it killed two fighters from the Al-Shabaab militant group in an airstrike Sunday in a remote part of Somalia's southern Jubaland state. The strike took place near Lipkas in the lower Juba region. The statement said no civilians were injured or killed, given the remote nature of where the engagements occurred. Rights activists have accused the United States of shrouding its Somalia operations in secrecy, potentially undermining accountability for incidents involving civilian deaths. International financial institutions are warning that some of Africa's biggest economies are close to economic collapse. Rising borrowing costs and inflation stoked by negative fallout from the war in Ukraine and the after effects of the COVID-19 pandemic have plunged countries including Egypt and Nigeria into big trouble. Zambia, meanwhile, is already a debt default. Darren Taylor reports.
Tunisia is one of several African countries desperately trying to cut a deal with the International Monetary Fund to avoid defaulting on sovereign debt repayments. Economists estimate Egypt has to pay $100 billion to creditors over the next 5 years. Ghana's currency has plummeted to record lows as its debt has soared. Kenya, currently with no access to capital markets, and with about 30% of revenues spent on interest repayments, is another traditionally strong economy in crisis. In 2020, Zambia became the first country to default during the COVID-19 era.
Zambia's debt stock at October 2021, when the new government moved into office, was about $14.4 billion. We're now somewhere around $17.1 billion of debt.
Zambian economist Yusuf Dodia says the debt burden's destroying his nation's economy. He points out that the 2021 budget allocated 46 billion kwacha, almost $3 billion, to servicing debt. This year, it's almost double that.
In other words, 45% of the national budget is going towards debt servicing, which of course starves other areas of economic endeavor from being funded by government resources.
Zambia's finance ministry is cancelling development projects valued at more than $2 billion. Dodia says Zambia accumulated its debt mostly in the past decade.
We built three international airports in Zambia. We have a couple of football stadiums, and that's debatable whether football stadiums constitute good debt or bad debt. We also built bridges across the Zambezi River into Botswana to make a very easy transition for trucks bringing goods and taking goods out of Zambia via Botswana. We also invested in the Kafue Gorge Lower Power Station, which is a hydroelectric power station, to supplement the electricity generation in Zambia.
Many of these projects were funded by China, to which Zambia now owes almost $6 billion, making Beijing its largest creditor. But Dodia says he doesn't see a way out of the debt hole for Zambia anytime soon.
Unfortunately, we have to borrow more money because there's a whole lot of economic infrastructure that needs to be developed in order for this country to truly grow and be able to generate revenue, not only to service debt, but also to finance the growth of the economy.
The IMF is trying to help Zambia restructure its debt to do that. Dodia says Lusaka's also negotiating with Beijing on repayments. He believes, however, that it could be time for Zambia to get into more good debt with China.
A country like Zambia that is landlocked, to make Zambia land-linked, we need a robust and wide railway network. And I think that China can provide the resources to develop a national railway network that would make the country operate more efficiently, more cost-effectively, and in fact, reduce of the huge amount of money that we put into road maintenance as a result of trucks carrying copper out of Zambia, not only for Zambia, but also...
Dodia says it doesn't make sense for a country that's the third biggest global copper producer to be in deep economic crisis. He's confident that with some smart work going forward, Zambia will emerge from its financial trouble. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Farhat Benghadara, who was appointed last week as head of the new board of directors for Libya's National Oil Corporation, has moved quickly to get the industry back on track, underscoring the importance of the task. The first board meeting included Prime Minister Abdul Hamid Dabiba and the ministers of oil and gas, finance and planning. Benghadara also announced the end of the oil blockade after talks with leading tribal figures from the oil crescent in Benghazi. But the Energy Committee of Libya's eastern-based parliament rejected a government move to sack the head of the National Oil Corporation, Mustafa Sonala, deepening a power struggle for control of the energy firm whose exports fund the nation. Wolfgang Porstei, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, discussed these developments with VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shanawi.
The sheikhs and notables of the tribes in the oil crescent stated during this joint press conference with Benghadara that one of their key demands had been met with the sacking of Sonala. It needs to be seen if there will be also a solution regarding the sharing of oil revenues, which is another key demand from the east and from the south. But this is not up to the boss of the National Oil Corporation. Benghadara intends to reach the 1.2 billion barrel per day mark, as it was before the oil blockade, within a few days, and plans to increase the production up to 3 million barrels per day within 3 years. That's almost doubled the level from before the revolution. To this end, he seeks additional international investors, but those are hesitant because of the lack of stability in Libya. Furthermore, many international investors have lost a huge amount of money during and after the 2011 revolution without any reimbursement. Additionally, if the production of Libya really stabilizes beyond 1.5 billion barrels per day, the country will certainly be also again subject to the OPEC production regulations.
The Energy Committee of Libya's Eastern-based Parliament rejected the government move to sack the head of National Oil Corporation, Mustafa Sonala, deepening a power struggle for control of the energy firm whose exports fund the Libyan nation. What could that rejection lead to?
Well, the Energy Committee of the AGR has certainly no real influence on the decisions of Prime Minister Dabeba. The various militias certainly could exert some pressure. But although especially several militias in Zawiya live very well with Sonala and the oil smuggling from the refinery there, I don't believe that his sacking will be a reason for war for them, especially as they would be clearly outnumbered. However, currently, there is a build-up of pro-Bashaga militias from Sintan, Rishifana, and Zawiya in the west and southwest of Tripoli. They have invited Bashaga to come to Tripoli with his government. On the other side, the pro-Dabeba Constitution and Election Support Force has also mobilized its forces in Tripoli. The situation is right now quite tense. We'll see how the situation develops in the next hours and days.
U.S.-Libya Ambassador Richard Norland said, "We are following the deep concern developments surrounding the National Oil Corporation," and he added that the producer had remained politically independent and technically competent under Mr. Sunallah. What does that mean?
To be honest, I disagree. The NOC is Libya's cash cow and as such highly political. It has provided money, the key asset, for all the governments in Tripoli to stay in power against the pressure from the various rivals since 2011 and has fueled the rampant corruption in Libya. So as long as the National Oil Corporation transfers the oil revenues from its bank accounts at the Libyan Foreign Bank solely to the government accounts at the Central Bank of Libya, as it is foreseen, it helps to hold one party in power against its opponents. May it be right or wrong, this is certainly not politically independent.
That was Wolfgang Parshtay, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, speaking with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shenawi. You're listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Please note, we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There, you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. The international medical aid group Médecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders, says up to 800,000 people displaced by a brutal Islamic insurgency in Mozambique's Cabo Delgado province are in dire need of health care, water, sanitation, and food. Attacks by the extremists and clashes between them and government forces have forced many people to flee their homes. The Southern Africa Development Community and the Rwanda have deployed troops to help restore calm, but the fighting continues. Tusokumalo reports from Johannesburg.
5 years after Islamic extremist groups started causing havoc in Cabo Delgado, there is no sign of the onslaught ending. Survivors say they have seen relatives killed with some decapitated. Médecins Sans Frontières, MSF, says those who fled their homes are facing starvation and disease. Mario Funo, MSF deputy head of mission in Cabo Delgado, told VOA that their doctors are being stretched to their limit as the number of displaced people increases.
This is the largest movement of displaced people so far in this year. Many people have fled multiple times, forced on each occasion to abandon their few possessions and means of survival. Specialist care of chronic medical conditions such as HIV, TB, is often unavailable despite the prevalence of this disease.
Those who have made it alive to the forests and havens provided by humanitarian organizations tell harrowing stories. Atija Baka, in her 60s, narrated a heartbreaking experience to MSF after she survived a senseless shooting by the insurgents. She says they were sitting relaxed at her home when they suddenly came under heavy fire with bullets flying all around them. They grabbed the children and ran for their lives. Unfortunately, her husband and son were killed. All they owned was burned to ashes. Suleiman Salim, in his 70s, told MSF researchers he now lives in the forest in Cabo Delgado's Nairoto area. He says when the war broke out, he and his family deserted their home and fled to the forest. For over a year, they survived through eating roots, tree leaves, and bushmeat if they were lucky to catch a wild animal. Younger victims include Samuel Alberto, who is in his 30s. He also spoke to the MSF team. He was in pain to explain the pain of living as a refugee in his own country, as he still cannot return to his village. He had a house and was able to feed his family. However, since he fled, he now stays in a safe camp where he is now fed like a child and spends the whole day sitting doing nothing. MSF says the situation of these and hundreds of thousands of others displaced by the war is dire. FUMO challenges donors and other humanitarian groups to help quickly.
With the violence continuing like this, hundreds of thousands of people are suffering from the effect of fear, violence, and displacement. Both in terms of their physical and their mental health, almost everyone has experienced trauma from witnessing or experiencing violence or losing their loved one or their homes.
Most citizens are worried that the troops sent by the SADC and Rwanda have been unable to stop the war. Along with the violence, MSF warns that the displaced will soon have to contend with starvation and diseases. Thuso Khumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
In Zimbabwe, the local currency keeps losing its value, forcing the market to demand the more stable U.S. dollar for most goods to guard against the depreciation. The government warns that this is illegal. It is difficult for consumers. Most of them are paid in the local currency. From Harare, reporter Kuzai Zanawashi looks at how consumers have had to adjust to rising inflation.
The beeping sound is that of goods being scanned by a till operator in a supermarket. The cost of living has dramatically changed over the year, forcing many to change their buying patterns. Ernest Musekiwa is a breadwinner who caters for a family of four.
Every day the prices are shooting up. Even your salary is not even enough to buy the most basic things that you want for your family. You know, if you look at the bread basket right now, it's beyond the reach of many.
Like other consumers, he has had to adapt to the changing environment.
It's becoming increasingly difficult for me to buy things that I really want, that I need for my family. If you check maybe a year ago, I would afford a lot of things, I'd afford basics. But now, basic things like bread, I can't even afford to buy bread on a regular basis. It has become a luxury. I've had to make do with buying flour.
Economist Vince Musewe explains how inflation is affecting retailers. He gives an example of Zimbabwe's biggest supermarket called OK.
Imagine if you're OK and you have to effectively change your prices every other day. It's laborious, isn't it? Imagine. It's just impossible. You have to look at all products every day. You are changing the price because the rate is increasing every day. The business just becomes unmanageable.
The government is trying to stabilize the economy, but this is happening against growing calls for salary increases by workers in both public and private sectors. Critics warn that if nothing is done, the situation may lead to an outbreak of strikes. Musewe advises that at a minimum, the government should accommodate workers by paying half of their salaries in US dollars to avoid erosion of their incomes. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zhinavashe from Harare.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Ihayes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Adrius Rigas, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays.